This Dharma talk, The Middle Way and Three Key Practice Questions by Mare Chapman, was recorded at the Women's Retreat on December 13th, 2019 at Holy Wisdom Monastery in Madison, Wisconsin.
So I want to thank you again for being here today, and in particular for practicing in such a sincere, dedicated way. I mean, it feels really, what we're creating here feels really wonderful. To me anyway, hope it does to you too. But really, it's not easy what we're doing. Instead of being at home with our families, doing holiday preparations, having fun, or goofing off, or getting lots of stuff done and crossing things off your list, you know, we're here. Practicing being aware of our authentic experience, moment by moment, and encouraging ourselves to respond to whatever's predominant with a lot of curiosity and kindness, acceptance, and without taking it to be who we actually are. This takes a lot of effort, and it's often hard and painful, physically and emotionally, and perhaps you've noticed that today. But this is all training in spiritual warriorship. Not warriorship in the sense of being aggressive and dominating, but rather in being skilled and adept in clear seeing and being responsive and flexible, resilient, wise and compassionate, loving and strong, courageous. It's training in being fearless, actually. And this path of practice is often called the middle way, meaning that we aim to not fall into the extremes of either self-indulgence or self-denial, of dualistic right or wrong thinking, of good or bad, of it's either this way or that way. Instead, we practice remaining in the middle, on the exact spot that we're in, aware of the whole, receptive and aware of all that we notice, and not assuming things will work out in a certain way. This means essentially that there's no reference point to fixate on, no resolution we can cling to. And this often makes us uncomfortable because we have a strong habit to strive for resolution and completion. We want security and comfort, assuming it's permanently attainable somehow. And you know, the world gives us all kinds of promises for this. We're seduced into believing we can have younger looking skin, whiter teeth, find the best partner, achieve the American dream, make everyone we love happy, live happily ever after, and then, of course, die the perfect death without suffering, without pain, right? But buying into these alluring hopes actually keeps us dissatisfied and restless, disappointed, and often blaming someone, very often ourselves, when life isn't working out this way. And our actual experience, reality, really shows us time and time again that this really isn't how life works. It simply isn't possible to make everything come out the way we want it to, the way we think it should. So in practicing this middle way, we're asked to cultivate an open state of mind that can relax with paradox and ambiguity. So we encourage ourselves to drop our judgments, our biases and assumptions, and instead practice beginner's mind. Practice don't know mind. Practice sincere curiosity. This is radical, of course, and it is absolutely honest, because we really don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. We don't know how our life will evolve. We don't know how this retreat will go, or what we'll encounter in our heart or mind or our body, even in the next moment, let alone tomorrow or the next year. And this, of course, absolutely goes against the grain of our conditioning as humans, and requires tremendous bravery because we're asking ourselves to completely change our view of reality. When we feel upset, scared, lonely, helpless, guilty, any kind of discomfort really, we don't want to sit and stay with this. We want resolution. We want ground under our feet. We want comfort again. We want relief ASAP. Yet the middle way encourages us to stay with our discomfort, to open to it and investigate it. It encourages us to awaken the bravery that is part of our true nature, that exists in everyone, all of us, without exception. And practicing this open state of mind, relaxing with ambiguity, frees us from these deep habits of our conditioning and enables us to access our true nature naturally. We get access to our basic goodness, our intelligence, our compassion, our generosity. It gives us access to the love beings that we truly are. However, in order to not veer to the right or to the left, to not assume good or bad, but stay in the middle and not wobble, it's helpful to have a clear understanding of the laws of nature so we can live in harmony with the way things actually are. So tonight, I want to first remind us of what are called in Buddhist philosophy the three marks of existence. And since mindfulness meditation is our training ground for accessing our natural bravery so we can follow this middle way, I want to offer some guidelines and specific practice suggestions for how we can work skillfully with our challenges, especially our difficult emotions. So the Buddha taught that there are three principal characteristics of human existence. These are impermanence, selflessness, and suffering. These are sometimes called the facts of life. When we can recognize these qualities as real and true, it can actually help us relax with reality. So intellectually, of course, we get impermanence. Oh yes, we know the weather changes, seasons change, everything in nature changes, and we're surely witnessing the effects of climate change profoundly now. And we're also experiencing tremendous changes worldwide and in our country regarding politics and power in our governments. Values that many of us thought were clear, correct, and established, like democracy, equality, respect and care for the welfare of all beings, we see are not at all permanent. And this is really scary. It creates a lot of wobble. And then, of course, we are always changing. We aren't the same as we were when we were 5 or 15 or 30 or 45 or a week ago. Physically, emotionally, cognitively, we're different. And we witness impermanence very clearly as we meditate. We're aware of the feeling of the breath. Then maybe we hear a sound. A story arises in our minds. An ache brings us back to the body. Perhaps there are some moments of inner quiet, and then there's movement, the mind talking and creating again. Moods shift and change like the weather. And even the most difficult physical pain doesn't actually stay the same forever. So this is very important to realize. Some changes we don't like, such as feeling that nagging headache intensifying. Some changes we do like when that headache wanes and disappears altogether. But impermanence makes life dynamic. It makes it creative and also pretty much out of our control. And even though we understand this intellectually, emotionally, we have tons of resistance to it. We want permanence. We somehow expect it. We seek security and control, and we're frustrated when we can't get it. And we tend to take it personally when we get everything all lined up in our life just the way we want it to be, and then get it to stay that way. I remember a very clear moment in my life. I know that it was a sunny day in June some years ago, when I joyfully realized that everything in my life was exactly the way I wanted it to be. It was perfect, actually. My relationship life was deeply satisfying. I felt no conflict or disappointment with anyone. My kids were good and healthy. My work life was great. My spiritual practice was satisfying and stable. My physical home was lovely. Financially, I was okay. My backyard was blooming with June flowers. My body felt healthy and strong. In realizing all of this, in this very clear moment, I said, okay, this is it. This is how it's supposed to be, right? And I felt extremely happy, fortunate, and also kind of smugly self-satisfied. I thought, all right, I made it. And then the very next day, something major changed in one of these dimensions. I can't actually remember what changed exactly. But I felt shocked and dismayed. And then I actually laughed out loud at myself because I realized that since I had thought this is how it was, my life was supposed to be, it would actually stay that way, at least for a good chunk of time. Whoops. Silly me. Impermanence, right? Perhaps because it's so hard to actually accept the truth of impermanence, the Buddha was generous enough to give us what are called the five remembrances or the five recollections. And he suggested that we recite them to ourselves daily as an act of wisdom and kindness towards ourselves to help this really sink in. And you likely know these, but I think it's good to remind ourselves of them, as he suggests, every day. So the first one is, I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. The second one is, I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. Number three, I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. Number four, all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. And number five, my actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. They are the ground on which I stand. The five remembrances. Clear, stark, simple, true, right? Now, we could find these reminders depressing, or we could square up to them and use them as inspiration to be here right now in this exact moment. We could use them as motivation to wake up and make the most of this temporary, very precious life. So the second mark of existence is selflessness. And as the five remembrances point out, as human beings, we are nature too. Every experience we have is fleeting, occurring only in this very moment. Everything we do, even if we've done it this one thing 1 million times before, if we're really paying attention, we see that our experience of it is ever so slightly different in this moment. Like making that really delicious cup of coffee in the morning, this morning was a new moment of doing it, and it was slightly different. But each interaction that we have with another person, each moment of experience is actually fresh and new, and we experience ourselves and each other differently. This means that there is actually no solid state me, no solid state you, no mare that is always the same mare, no Cecily that is always the same Cecily. Before this understanding, I would sometimes chastise myself because I really had gotten the idea that I was supposed to be the same. I don't know if you ever got that message, but I did. I thought I was always actually supposed to be pleasant, kind, responsive, and of course, fine. Right? And I think I believed that if I was consistent, then people would know they could always count on me to be this certain way, and then I would be liked and loved. I think it was that simple. But then when I'd feel grumpy and not fine, or I didn't have the energy to respond, I'd turn against myself. This isn't how I'm supposed to be. But now in understanding this reality, I'm not consistent, and this is natural, I can be a lot kinder to myself. It's freeing. Remembering this helps us approach situations without expectations or assumptions. I truly don't know how I will experience myself or you. And remembering this can keep us fresh and really open to the moment. Selflessness is also called no self, not self, or sometimes egolessness or emptiness. Of course, this doesn't mean that we disappear or something like that, but rather it means that our experience of ourself is mutable. The basic view is that there is actually no permanent self that exists independently from everything else and is always the same. How we experience ourselves in any given moment is a result of innumerable causes and conditions coming together in that moment. So we might more accurately think of ourselves as being more like kaleidoscopes, a unique basic essence being the various colored gems held in the cylinder And then each experience we have is like another turn of the kaleidoscope, creating a slightly different arrangement of our colored gems, a somewhat different display of ourselves, and never repeating in exactly the same arrangement as previous configurations. But the habits of our conditioning make it hard to perceive this. They bias our experience and incline us to believe otherwise. Our conditioned belief train us and train our minds to develop fixed and distorted ideas about ourselves. We develop self-definitions like, I'm shy always, or I'm too much, or I'm too loud, or I'm too sensitive, or I'm damaged goods, I'm a nervous Nelly, something wrong with me. These self-definitions cause us tremendous suffering because they trigger a lot of repetitive inner narratives, lots of painful feelings, and sometimes create serious mental health issues. And they make us feel separate and disconnected from each other and painfully self-absorbed. They keep us slave to our assumptions, to our likes and our dislikes, to our critical judgments and conclusions, and really trapped in dualistic thinking. And as women born into this misogynistic patriarchal culture, we're viewed as subordinate to men in so many ways. The messages we get both directly and indirectly to keep ourselves small, quiet, good, meaning in control, I think, keep ourselves available and pleasing, these messages wound and warp our sense of self. We develop beliefs that we're not okay the way we are, which makes it really hard to trust and respect ourselves. Habits of turning against ourselves disconnect us from our authentic experience, and we lose our agency all too easily. All too often, we cling to the belief that if we could just be perfect enough, especially in the eyes of others, then we'd be accepted, loved, and secure. And this often sets us up on a lifelong path that can cripple us. And as we know, these habits of othering create chronic self-doubt, anxiety, self-hatred, shame, depression, giving our power away to others, and losing ourselves over and over again in relationships. But by understanding that in actual reality there is no solid permanent self to cling to, and that we, like everything else, are not fixed and solid, we can more easily challenge these oppressive, incorrect beliefs. Through practice, we can heal our relationship with ourselves by letting go of these ideas and learn to reside in the reality and freedom of our basic goodness and our authentic self. As we practice this middle way, we will discover this way of being creates a much more flexible self-identity, an ability to be adaptive and playful and curious and responsive to what's happening. We're more able to relax with ourselves just as we are in the moment. And we can take ourselves a lot less seriously and with a lot more humor, which is a really good thing. And of course, this translates into our relationships with others. We realize that everybody else is just like us, always changing as well. None of us are trapped in a fixed identity. And if we can train in remembering and practicing this, our relationships, even the ones we've had our entire life, that can at times feel old and stale, can become fresh and alive again. The third mark of existence is suffering, or dukkha, or dissatisfaction. As Suzuki Roshi taught, it is only by practicing through a continual succession of agreeable and disagreeable experiences that we acquire true strength. To accept that pain is inherent in life and there is no independently existing permanent self and live from these understandings actually creates the causes and conditions for true happiness. But we forget and resist these laws of nature and we suffer. And so even though pain is actually a given, it's the 10,000 sorrows that's paired with the 10,000 joys of life that we hear about in these teachings, we somehow think we can avoid it. Pema Chodron suggests that we're born with a craving for security and resolution that pervasively governs our thoughts and words and actions. She says we're like people in a boat that's falling apart and trying desperately to hold on to the water. We don't like it that everything's always changing and dynamic. We especially don't like that it's out of our control, and that it's sometimes or often unpleasant. We don't like discomfort, pain, restlessness, insecurity, and loss. I've heard Pema say many, many times, as human beings, we should never underestimate our preference for the pleasant. Right? We always prefer it. In our various addictions and exit strategies, like keeping busy, checking our phones, grazing in the kitchen for something soothing to eat or drink, shopping, dwelling on others, they're all attempts to keep our experience as pleasant as possible and avoid our fears of this naturally fluid, shifting world. But because this isn't how life actually is, we aren't perceiving reality accurately, we suffer. The fact that we have such intolerance for discomfort, sometimes even the slightest discomfort or edginess, is a problem for us because it keeps us searching for relief. And because our exit strategies and addictions do give us temporary relief from what we believe is intolerable, these habits give us some sense of control and predictability. But because we keep getting hooked by them, we stay caught in the cycle of samsara. We stay caught in dukkha. And I think, too, because we live in these separate bodies and have our own unique histories and physical lives, it's hard for us to get that ultimately we're all connected and not separate. The way our conditioned minds create story after story about ourselves, a me, imagining others' views and judgments of us, comparing ourselves to others, forming conclusions about ourselves, creates the illusion that we are solid and separate. We can get hung up on being the worst or the best meditator, the worst or the best mother, the worst or the best friend, coworker, you know how it is. That inner soundtrack and movie our minds spin is so prevalent and convincing. It creates the appearance that our separate self-existence is real. Yet it is really all a dream. So in sitting meditation, walking meditation, yoga, eating mindfully, practicing seamlessness of attention as we're doing here on retreat, encouraging ourselves to be precise and sensitive to all we notice, we can witness these three marks of existence playing out. We observe the actual changing flow of experience moment by moment. We see our thoughts arise and pass away, sensations form and stay for a while and dissolve, moods roll in and out, sounds are heard for a while and fade away. We practice shifting out of the mind stories that construct our imaginings of self, moving attention back to the breath and body and actual reality over and over. Perhaps we experience moments of resting in the peacefulness of open awareness without a story of self at all. The quiet expanse of freedom of resting in non-self, selfless for a moment. So through our practice, we're educating ourselves about these facts of life. We're getting a little bit more comfortable with uncertainty, with not knowing, with ambiguity, with no fixed reference point, with the middle way of being. Yes, a little bit. But since we're all works in progress and impermanence rules, sooner or later something happens that hooks us, and we instantly pop out of this open middle way state. Dukkha has arrived again. Perhaps a memory of a difficult interaction where you felt dismissed and hurt, or worry and dread about an important upcoming event arose in your mind. And then without a moment's notice, we lose our inner spaciousness. We conclude that something's wrong, and we scramble for solid ground. We have a definite reference point now. We want to fix, change, and get out of this uncomfortable state. And we may try using our most familiar exit strategies, analyzing what's happening, trying to figure it out to gain a sense of control, or blaming ourselves or someone else and solidifying our sense of self. Or distracting ourselves to avoid what we're feeling. We all have our favorite attempts to escape what's uncomfortable. But we know they don't really help us much in the long run. So when this inevitably happens, we can bring three essential practice questions to our experience to help us relate skillfully to it and to find the openness of the middle way again. These three practice questions come from Ezra Beda, a wonderful Zen teacher in the San Diego area. I've been using these questions for a while, and I find them really helpful. And the three questions are, can I welcome this as my path? What is my most believed thought? And the last one is, what is this? What is this? So the first question, can I welcome this as my path, is critical because if we don't ask it, we're likely to remain stuck in resistance and caught in our various attempts to flee from reality. And perhaps by now we've practiced our habitual reactions often enough to know that they really don't lead us to freedom. It's helpful to remember that the wise view that when we're hooked and upset, it's our system's way of saying, hey, wake up, pay attention, please. Something important is going on, otherwise I wouldn't be feeling this right now. This helps us turn towards our unpleasant experience rather than away from it. And I think it really is true, even though there may be moments in which we are sick of hearing this, that opening to our distress in these skillful ways truly is an opportunity to understand ourselves more deeply and to possibly cleanse ourselves from some inner debris that blocks our freedom. So when someone criticizes us and we react defensively, or someone disappoints us and we feel sad or angry, or we've just slammed ourselves with shaming judgments, can we turn towards our uncomfortable feelings and welcome them as our path? One prominent habit pattern coming out of my conditioning, where my mom was too absorbed in her own anxiety to be authentically present and able to listen to me, is that I can be very reactive about not being heard. Consequently, my dearest people are those who are able to be present and listen deeply. Listen to others, listen to themselves, and listen to me. So on the rare occasions when my partner isn't able to listen to me when there's something important I really want to say, usually it's something I'm excited or passionate about, but instead she's pulled into tending to our dog or reading emails on her phone or just doesn't have the bandwidth to want to listen, I've historically reacted by feeling hurt and angry. I judge her and make her wrong. I feel sorry for myself. And I spin critical stories about her and the imperfections in our relationship. I slam my heart shut, and I contract and I pull in. But when I'm aware of my reaction and I remember the question, can I welcome this as my path? I instantly regain my agency. I remember this is an old neural groove that I'd really like to heal, and I can more easily drop my resistance and reactive strategies. And in this way, I'm being present with myself. I'm listening to myself right now, which is what I was longing for all along. And I then find my heart can open again and I can feel compassion for both of us. My mind shifts from making her wrong into remembering and respecting that she has needs and limits too. When we can remember that our distress and discomfort is not the obstacle, but the path itself, the path to healing and freedom, we can shift out of the dualistic habit of right or wrong and aim ourselves towards the spaciousness and the freedom of the middle way. Of course, it's vital to be gentle and kind and so tender with ourselves as we do this. This is not about forcing ourselves to open. We need to take the reality of the current conditions and situation and our own energy into account here. For example, a woman in a practice class spoke about her adorable 5-month-old grandson who was born with a large, rare, cancerous tumor. And since his birth, has gone through intensive chemotherapy and is now facing surgery to remove the tumor. She's been practicing diligently to stay stable and receptive to this very difficult, heartbreaking, and uncertain reality about what will happen to him. As she was heading to the hospital to support her daughter and son-in-law and grandson on this next scary leg of the treatment, she said, "I'm working on accepting that this is my path, but there's no way in hell I'll be welcoming this as my path," right? Indeed, some of life's challenges are way bigger than others, and we need to honor this. The second key practice question from Ezra Beda is, what is my most believed thought? Since our most deeply held beliefs are at the root of much of our emotional distress, it's healing and liberating to discover them. But the answer to this question often isn't obvious right away because the root belief is frequently out of our conscious awareness. These beliefs were formed without our conscious consent as we grew up. and more often than not tend to be blatantly untrue. I actually like to frame them as lies or delusions we thought were true about ourselves. To find them is helpful to first discover the surface thoughts that have provoked our reaction, because this clears the way for the deeper held belief thoughts to surface. And as we know, thoughts go through the mind so quickly that much of the time we're not aware of the actual story the mind has just spun. We just know we're hooked and we're feeling upset. So when that's the case, I find it's often helpful to ask, well, what was I just imagining? What was I just telling myself? What movie did my mind just play? This can prompt recall of these first-level reactive thoughts. Like in the example of my partner not listening to me, my reactive story was something like, see, she doesn't really care about me. I'm not interesting enough for her. Plus, she's always elsewhere. Our communication sucks, and it's probably always going to. It's really useful to spot the exact story so we can see it clearly for what it truly is: huge judgments and grossly inaccurate conclusions. As well, given this narrative, it's no wonder I felt hurt, angry, and I shut down, given what I said to myself, right? I find there's always direct logic to our upsets, given the reactive story the mind created. It's illuminating to realize, too, that the reactive thoughts always involve a me, always involve the creation of a self, one way or another. So at this point, it's really helpful to remember the wise view about thoughts, that the mind thinks. That's what it does. A tremendous volume of thoughts. And some of our thoughts are true and constructive and really beneficial and wise. And many of our thoughts are not at all accurate or helpful. In fact, they create our misery and our hell. And it's our thinking mind that constructs and proliferates ideas of a self. When we're experiencing an emotional upset, particularly when this feeling is a frequent visitor, we're pulled into our conditioning big time. So our ego and our sense of self naturally get provoked. And since our thoughts are biased and not accurate, it's vital to not believe everything we think. We need to know what we're thinking, what the surface story is, but we're wise to not believe it. Discernment is key here. Discovering our most believed thought is not an analytical endeavor. It's not about digging in and trying harder. That approach simply creates more tension because there's attachment to finding it. Rather, this is really a practice in being deeply receptive to ourselves. Remember, we've been living with ourselves every moment of our lives, so we have all the data about ourselves. The root belief to this distress is in our data bank somewhere. It's simply a matter of creating the most useful conditions that will allow it to come into our awareness. I find what's most helpful is to hold the question really gently, spaciously, in a relaxed way. Though we're honestly wanting to discover this about ourselves, there's no forcing it. As we practice holding the question softly, the answer then has the inner space it needs to arise spontaneously. But if the answer doesn't show itself after some time of asking it and kind of cradling it, then it's probably best to drop it for the moment and shift to the third question. Then perhaps a little while later, we might ask the question again. But sooner or later, as we stay with our experience in this way, the most deeply held delusion, lie, or misunderstanding will most likely show itself, I find. So when I asked, what is my most believed thought when my partner can't listen to me, and I have my intense reaction of judging and shutting down, feeling hurt, I discovered that there were actually two beliefs. One was, whatever I have to say is not worthy of anyone's attention. And the other, even deeper belief, I don't matter. When I first realized these were the root beliefs to my reaction, I felt incredible sorrow and compassion for myself. And as I opened to this sadness, letting it be, giving it a lot of space, what also arose was the clarity that these beliefs are not at all true. Understanding this has greatly deepened my knowing and acceptance of myself over time. So now when this old reaction gets triggered, it's much easier to turn compassionately towards myself, allow space for these old reactions without feeding them with untrue judgments and conclusions, and then listen deeply to myself on the spot. As I do so, I witness the discomfort shifting much more quickly. The third practice question, what is this, instructs us to bring curiosity, beginner's mind, and sincere, precise interest to our direct physical experience of the upset. This can't be answered by thinking, but by observing and exploring all the physical qualities and properties of what we're feeling. So we shift our attention away from the me storyline and the root beliefs, if we found them, into the body. This is probably the most difficult and also the most important question to practice because it goes against our instincts and habits to want to avoid the unpleasant sensations of the disturbance. We have to refrain from our most habitual defenses like distracting ourselves, dissociating, trying to fix our experience, shooting second arrows, or blaming others, all of which are aimed at trying to gain control and get away from the discomfort. But these defenses aren't helpful because they keep us pulled into the storyline of me. They fuel the distress and keep us caught in it a lot longer. So when we move our attention under the storyline and ask, where do I feel this in my body like right now with a lot of curiosity? What sensations do I actually feel right now with this anxiety, this hurt, or this anger? What's the felt sense of it? When we ask those questions, we aren't asking what it's about, which is analyzing and shoots us right back into our ideas, but rather, exactly how am I experiencing this right now? What is this? Just like working with uncomfortable sensations that are physically generated by the body, like a backache or a headache or an itch, we do the same with feelings of emotional pain. To keep our attention in the body, we can ask questions like, what's the size and shape of this queasiness, this heaviness, or this tightness? Is it still or is it moving? Is it solid or hard? Or soft and malleable, and so on. As we get to know the exact sensations and stay with them, we practice holding them all gently and spaciously, letting everything be just the way it is. And as we allow the sensations to just be, awareness then becomes a wider and wider container that allows the experience to simply change on its own. And in this unwinding and opening process, we're naturally resting in the spaciousness of our true nature. We then see how it changes naturally on its own, and how this whole upset is really just a combination of belief thoughts and physical sensations. The sensations of the hurt, mad, and shutdown that I felt when my partner couldn't listen to me was a combination of heavy tightness in my chest and heart area that spread down into my belly. And the whole area felt really hard, shield-like, still, unmoving, and solid. As I opened to these feelings just as they were, holding them gently and spaciously, now understanding their root belief and letting them be, they began to soften, and soon that softening allowed my whole chest and belly to relax again, and I could feel my heart opening again to both of us. Of course, residing in the what is this of our experience takes great courage because we're asking ourselves to enter directly into the discomfort we feel, and this vulnerability goes against our conditioning. But with practice, along with being very gentle and compassionate, we build tolerance for the discomfort, and we gain our understanding of reality, that it's actually more painful to try to push away distress than to actually open to it and feel it. We also deepen our understanding of ourselves and we cultivate confidence in our spiritual warriorship. We are building the inner strength and courage that we can handle what is difficult and painful to bear. So the next time you're pulled into a difficult emotion, maybe you reach your limit with that woman disturbing you because she's breathing too loudly and now you're irked, or your mind offers up a memory of an old mistake and you're sucked into that yucky guilty feeling, can you consider it an opportunity rather than a problem? When we can remember the emotional discomfort we feel is actually a teacher, a chance to grow and heal and find more freedom, and by employing these three practice questions, can I welcome this as my path? What's my most believed thought? And what is this? Then we turn toward rather than away from our distress. We learn more about the actual truth of existence, impermanence, selflessness, and suffering. And we're training ourselves to become a bit more comfortable with uncertainty, with abiding in the middle way. We're evolving to being able to live with ambiguity and without a fixed reference point. We're cultivating our open mind and heart. We're accessing our bravery. We're building the inner security that we can trust ourselves, our wisdom, and our basic goodness. We're trusting the love being that we truly are. And because we're all interconnected and ultimately not separate, as we do this with ourselves, everyone benefits. We naturally bring more wisdom and love and health into our relationships and into our world. So I want to end with a poem by Jennifer Wellwood called Unconditional. Opening to my loss, willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant, jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is purest delight, to honor its form, true devotion. Let's sit for a minute, shall we?